This wasn't one of those times. "Escort them across the Granford Bridge," she ordered, still speaking in Frey. "Give them food and water, in the necessary quantity for a journey to Erevan. Then let them go." Smiles brightened the faces of both prisoners as the guards hauled them out. "You're being foolish," Nefren said quietly, switching back to Runic. "And also weak. Weakness is no way to run a territory." "I'm not running a territory. I'm leading a war." "All the more reason. You need to be more decisive, less accommodating." "You may feel comfortable kicking your feet up in your home, but I have not forgotten that I am living in the house of my enemy. They watch us. You don't notice, but the Frey in the city stare at us with loathing. Padera cooks my food because the Frey chefs refuse. Roan and her smiths are struggling to produce weapons and armor, working in Elenrist's smithy. But your metal workers refuse to help. They don't know how to make iron, and refuse to learn from a rune. It's as if those Frey who chose to stay did it in expectation of our failure. They're waiting for us to give up and go home so they can scrub the smell of us off their floors and return to their old lives. What does that have to do with... To date, only Shigon and Grindel have died at the hands of runes, and no Frey has been killed while I've been the Kenig. The Frey are watching. If I execute two high-ranking Frey, if they witness two of their own being murdered by humans, their tolerance may well fade. I already have one war on order. I don't need another conflict inside the walls of my fortress. You keep power with fear, not compassion. Fear of the Fane united the runes and made you the Kenig. Fear of the Kenig will keep your people and mine united when they no longer fear the Fane. I don't want my people to fear me. They shouldn't have to fear anyone. That's the whole point. A fine ideal, which you should repeat in public every chance you get. Persephone frowned. She didn't want to be sucked into the same old argument, mostly because she was starting to think Nefren might be right. Initially, the gleaming Frey Lord had terrified her, but over the last year she'd come to depend on him for so much. Unlike the clan chieftains, Nefren, in fact, all the Frey, hadn't showed the slightest concern with her being both a military leader and a woman. She knew that, until recently, the Frey had been ruled by a female thane named Fenelaus, who led them to victory against the Derg. Nefren in particular had been very supportive. Persephone found it odd how she felt more comfortable with and accepted by a member of another race than she had by her own husband, which made resisting Nefren's counsel all the more difficult. "How many more prisoners are there?"
"You're changing the subject," Nefren told her.
"She can do that. She's the Kenig," Moya said, while smiling innocently.
Persephone was certain she had the only shield capable of wielding her eyes as a deadly weapon.
"And good shields are supposed to be silent," Nefren replied.
A year ago, such a comment would have terrified both of them. Instead, Persephone braced herself for the inevitable reply. Moya always had a reply.
"And Frey are supposed to be gods."
Moya shrugged.
"Isn't life just full of disappointments?"
Moya's mouth! Persephone had mentally turned the phrase into a curse. The three of them had spent nearly every day of the winter together, planning and organizing. At first, Persephone was certain Moya would get them both killed. She loved the girl to death, but Moya could make difficult situations impossible. Then, by the first snows, she realized Nefren invited attacks. he appeared to enjoy her barbs. By midwinter, the two were regularly greeting each other with scathing insults. To aid her, Moya had Tek Chin teach her Frey profanity. "How many more prisoners?" Persephone asked again. Nefren continued to look at Moya a moment longer, then shifted over. "A little more than 100."
100? Why so many? I thought Instaria never disobeyed their superiors.
Moya jabbed again.
Moya!
Thankfully, this time, Nefren ignored her.
Petrogar and Vertimus are the only Frey down there.
You have humans imprisoned? Persephone asked.
No,
he replied, as if the question was ridiculous. Dwarfs?
Why would we imprison dwarfs?
I don't know. But what else could there be?
We use the donjon as holding pens, mostly. Patrols sometimes capture goblins, wheelos, or bankors. We even had an Ariface once. And for a few years we had a white bear that we named Alpola, after a Grenmorian legend of a snow giant.
Persephone didn't know what most of those words meant, but imagined a menagerie of mystical creatures, a terrifying collection of nightmares under her feet.
What do you do with them? Study, mostly. We learn weaknesses and strengths, attitudes, motivations, and languages, if applicable.
Are we done here? Moya asked.
At midday, she taught the bow to 100 would-be archers.
Looks like it.
Persephone was getting the nod from the door guard, who closed the chamber on that side.
Then I'm off to belittle and humiliate this month's crop of manhood.
How are they doing?
Nefren asked, as he stood up, and they headed toward the judge's door.
Very well.
But don't tell them that.
This is part of the same group I had back in autumn, and I'm pleased to find they've kept up with their practice.
Any standouts?
Nefren held open the door for the two women. Moya nodded.
A kid named Tesh is the best. He loves challenging me.
Nefren was nodding. Sebek has the same problem with that boy.
He's a natural, very athletic and driven. I've seen him practicing in weather so cold that stone cries. Made himself a pair of gloves without fingertips on his right hand, so he could better feel the string. And he's the only one, besides me, who can hold 5 arrows in the draw hand. The rest of my trainees hold them in their bow hand, which slows them down. Tesh isn't accurate enough, and he's not thrusting the shot with his bow hand, but he can loose 3 arrows faster than you can say your own name.
He's been asking for armor.
Nefren closed the door behind them.
Wants to get used to the weight and balance. They keep telling him he's not done growing, but that hasn't stopped him from asking.
He's Duraean, you know,
Moya said, as they entered the Kype's main hall, which was dominated by the huge doors and dangling chandeliers. Not a shaft of sunlight entered. The Kype was the fortress within the fortress. The only windows were 7 stories up, and very narrow.
Explains why Wraith appointed him as his shield. Well, that and great foresight on Wraith's part. That kid is going to be a killer one day.
Persephone insisted on climbing to the top of the Spyrock once a day. She wanted to see the world, and there was no better view than from there. She also loved leaving behind the shackles of her Koenig duties. If only for an hour, she could be just one of the birds that circled the tower. Recently, Nefren had taken to joining her. At first, she'd found it irritating. This had been her alone time. She climbed the 1,000 steps, which she counted on 5 separate occasions, to find solitude. He was an invader. Yet, as intruders went, the Lord of Alenrist had proven to be charming. Somehow that didn't quite fit, but was as close as she could come. How else could she describe how he matched her embarrassingly slow progress and pretended to need the occasional rest? The two reached the top and looked east at all creation, cast in shimmering gold by a setting sun behind them. Wind blew. Wind always blew up there, and Persephone gripped the icy stone ledge and leaned into the cold gusts, which felt good after the long climb. The world appeared so beautiful. Hard to believe that, out of that splendour, death marched toward them. "Do you think it will be soon?" Persephone asked.
"Yes," Nephron replied. "The Fane will have built his new army over the winter. Same as us. I suspect they are already on the move."
"How long, then?"
"We have time. Armies, even experienced ones, are notoriously slow. Supply lines need to be established, which will be the first thing we'll target after the initial battle. Disrupt an enemy's supplies, and it's like poisoning a village well. Everybody leaves."
"You've fought in many battles?"
He nodded with a smile that said he was being modest.
He walked around the circle of the parapet with his arms outstretched.
"These mountains, forests, rivers, and caves were my playground. I grew up exploring every crag, cleft, and shadow. And those that came with me became legends."
He looked out at the purple and gold of the most distant peaks and sighed. She thought she saw sadness in his eyes, and realized he was likely remembering fallen comrades. "Have you lost many Galantians over the years?" He appeared surprised and shook his head.
"Just two.
Medak and Stryker were the first."
She felt foolish for never having offered condolences for— "Stryker wasn't a Galantian," he said with a little chuckle. "Stryker was a goblin. One of the many guests of the Durjan. I pulled him out of his hole, thinking he might be useful."
"And Grigor? Is he a Galantian?"
Nephron shrugged. "Sort of. We picked him up a few centuries ago in Hentlin, during a clan dispute where—"
"He's that old?"
"Grenmorians age like trees. Act like them, too. Some fall asleep for years. The bigger ones, especially. Fergenrock, the ruler of the dominant rock clan, allegedly fell asleep for so long that dirt built up on him, grass grew, and sheep were grazing on his face. Legend holds that one little lamb tugged on an eyelash, and what was known as Mount Ferg, for reasons no one could by then remember, got up and turned out to be Fergenrock himself." Persephone smiled as she imagined a mountain getting up and dusting himself off.
"My father was the leader of the Instaria tribe. That made him Lord of Alan Rist, commander of the whole frontier. This granted me certain privileges, although not too many, as my father wasn't one for favoritism. But I was allowed to handpick my cohort. I chose only a few, but that was all I needed, because I picked the best."
He placed his hands on the balcony ledge and looked out.
"And the adventures we had."
He sighed again.
"But I'm no longer 500, and there comes a time when you have to grow up, I suppose."
He turned to her, looked straight into her eyes, and asked,
"Have you had time to consider the proposal I mentioned when we arrived? I don't mean to push, and I admit that I have very little knowledge of rune customs when it comes to marriage, so I apologize if I appear to be rushing things."
Once again, Persephone was caught by surprise.
"More than half a year between comments wouldn't be considered a rush."
"Good," he said, and waited. Persephone felt flustered. To be honest, I haven't given the idea that much consideration. We've been together nearly every day, and you've never... I mean... I guess I thought you might not have been serious. Or you might have changed your mind.
Not at all. I merely wanted to give you the necessary time to evaluate the proposal.
I was right. Charming really isn't the right word.
Persephone had contemplated the proposal a great deal over the winter, so much so that she'd refused to meet privately with Wraith, even though he attempted to see her dozens of times. During council meetings, where all the chieftains were present, she made a point of avoiding him. Persephone couldn't afford to be alone with Wraith, not even for a second. Over several cold months of contemplation, she determined that Nephron was right. Their union wasn't merely advantageous. It was necessary. Persephone also realized that, despite everything, she loved Wraith. Probably since the day I met him. Back then it wasn't an option. Reglan's death was so fresh, and they faced so many troubles.
I made excuses. He was too young. He didn't believe in me. Didn't believe in fighting. His dreams were childish, selfish things.
But even though he knew he couldn't win, he would have fought the Gula champion for her. And he was still there. Still in Alenrist, training men. He hadn't seen her in months, but the man hadn't left.
I'm running out of excuses.
And she missed him more than she ever expected she would. Strange how infrequently I thought about Wraith when he was here, but how important the man has become in his absence. Thoughts of love had always been a luxury before, frivolous and indulgent, but now she had to think. She needed to decide, and that decision led her to a comparison. Nephron made his argument, which, while sensible, felt cold and empty. In his absence, Wraith couldn't defend himself. He also couldn't ruin the growing appreciation that bloomed in a rich soil of selected memories that became all the rosier in light of Nephron's calculated arrangements. All of her mental debates, all of her reasons to choose the fray, sounded foolish against the powerful backdrop of longing that, instead of diminishing as she had hoped, had grown stronger. At first she had been ridiculously busy. Now she didn't dare allow herself to see Wraith, to be alone with him. The winter had made her weaker. This couldn't be a selfish decision. That was a girl's choice. She was a woman. A Keenig. Her own happiness couldn't get in the way of that. Persephone looked back at him with a concerned frown.
Do you even like me?
Nephron drew his head back in surprise.
Is that important?
I think so, yes. I'm not saying you have to be in love with me. I've seen Frey women, and guess you find me somewhere between ugly and grotesque. But for a successful marriage, I certainly think a genuine, if only general, affection of some kind is necessary.
He nodded thoughtfully.
I believe I can honestly say I have enjoyed your company this past winter.
Oh! Well, that's wonderful. I hope you didn't strain yourself with that admission.
She turned away and crossed the parapet to the south side. Leaning on the wall once more, she stared out at the Burn and Urum river valleys without seeing either. These climbs were so much more enjoyable alone.
You seem absurd.
Me?
No. Not at all.
She refused to look at him. His blank, bewildered stare was too infuriating. Why am I so angry?
Nephrim was being forthright and honest, offering her a very sensible arrangement that would benefit nearly everyone. To her knowledge, there had never been a Frey human marriage. Such a thing would go a long way toward eliminating misconceptions and establishing respect between the races. That was the real battle. The real war that needed winning.
So why does it hurt?
Persephone remembered the first time they scaled the Spyrock together. She recalled laughing with him when, after climbing those 1,000 steps, they couldn't open the door to the balcony because of the late winter snow. They'd just sat there, slumped on the top step, cursing the gods. She remembered how he'd lent her his coat, putting it on her so thoughtfully, and how he'd caught her when she slipped on the ice and held her hand as they crossed the rest of the bridge on their way to the General Assembly for the Midwinter Address. His hand had felt warm. It had felt good. It had felt like...
I thought maybe he...
Do you still need more time to decide? He asked.
Yes, she replied.
And then, biting her lip, she sucked in an unsatisfying breath. Spring was supposed to be a time of new beginnings, a renewal, of love and the joy of rebirth. Instead, spring was just a time of waiting, and death was on its way.
Chapter 11. Monsters in the Dark. He was handsome, brave, strong, and 16. Neither one of us knew what we were doing. We did not care. The Book of Bryn.
Tesh wiped the sweat from his eyes. Sebek had beaten him again, but just barely. Tesh had also very nearly lost a hand. The better he got, the nastier Sebek became.
"You're still watching my blades too much, Teklor," Sebek told him.
The Frey wasn't sweating, not even out of breath.
"The story is in my eyes."
"Your eyes lie,"
Sebek grinned.
"Noticed that, did you?
Nearly lost my hand because of it."
Sebek's mouth grinned while his eyes laughed.
"Yes, you did."
Despite Tesh's success, the other trainees avoided Sebek, which was likely his intent. With no students, he spent his days drinking in the sun and shouting curses at the pitiful performance of the sword-fighting hopefuls. The insults started in Runic, but as he got drunk, Sebek slipped into Frey. By the end of the day, he routinely threw things. Sebek was also, undeniably, the best living warrior. Having trained with all the Galantians, Tesh knew this to be true. Ares had no match with a spear. Tekchin remained peerless with a thin, long blade. They all had specialties, but everyone knew that if the whole of the world fought, Sebek would be the last one standing. He was more than a pair of short blades, more than lean muscle, more than finely honed technique. Sebek was a killer. He enjoyed the sight of blood. Even the other Galantians didn't challenge him. Tesh made a habit of it. He relentlessly dogged Sebek. At first, the Frey laughed at the stupid kid with the death wish. When Tesh refused to let up, Sebek taught him a lesson. Tesh had bled, but he'd also learned. Sebek hadn't believed it when Tesh came back for more. After a few more short-lived instructions in humiliation, Sebek became intrigued at the suicidal toddler who learned from his mistakes. When Tesh deflected an attack with a bare palm, Sebek stopped calling him stupid. He even stopped calling him kid. Tesh's new name was Teklor, Swift Hand. He was pretty sure Sebek never knew his real name. Positive the Frey didn't care.
Tesh didn't care either. All he wanted was to learn what Sebek could teach. All Tesh wanted was to be the best.
"He's just trying to scare you, Teklor," Ares said.
The Galantian reclined on the grass of the courtyard, his hands behind his head, his chest bare to the sun. They were all there, all except Nephron. The Galantians found the matches between Sebek and Tesh as entertaining as the trainees did. Sebek liked the attention and usually put out the word that he'd be teaching Teklor again, which brought the rest running.
"He should be scared."
Sebek returned his blades to their scabbards.
"Give him a break," Grigor said.
He was sitting by the barracks wall, struggling to repair a tear in the sleeve of his shirt.
"The kid is out here every day, and most of the night."
"If we had 100 like him," Sakaar said, "we could invade Erevan and be done with it."
"He's not that good," Sebek said.
"He's the best rune I've ever seen,"
Sakaar put in. Sebek gave Sakaar a dismissive glance.
"I'm not interested in the best rune. What good is that?"
Sakaar got up and dusted grass off his legs.
"Just saying, he's practically an infant, and he's been training with us for less than a year, and already he's dangerous. Just imagine if he had been in Nadak or Dorea when they were burned."
Sakaar paused and looked at Tesh.
"Oh, wait. You're Dorean, aren't you? Thought I heard someone saying that. Where were you when the attacks came? Out hunting or something?"
Tesh didn't answer. He'd spotted Bryn sitting in the grass across the courtyard. He pointed at her and smiled.
"Sorry, can't talk. More important matters to attend to."
He followed this with a wicked grin and trotted away. Bryn was leaning up against the lamppost in front of the smithy with that same satchel in her lap. He grabbed his shirt and crossed the yard. Tesh expected Sebek to make a comment about the pitfalls of women, an insult, at the very least. He didn't. The only sounds were the light-hearted taunts of the boys and men in his squad, none of which he bothered addressing. Tesh thought Bryn was the best-looking girl in Alan Rist. An argument could be made that this wasn't such a big deal, since there were little more than 50 rune females within a day's walk, and most of them were old or married. Still, some were worth looking at, like the archery instructor. But he didn't dare look at her. She scared him even more than Sebek. Besides Bryn, the only other girl his age was Nixie, who lived with her mother down by the goat pens. She was all right. He tried to speak to her once, but her mother was quick to shoo him away.
"You shouldn't talk to that Dorean boy," he heard her say.
The mother's tone made Dorean sound like a disease. Bryn was better looking than Nixie, nicer, and she didn't have a mother. She didn't have a father, either. This was something they shared, and Tesh imagined it connected them in some way, or was maybe a sign from the gods. A big, eternal hand pointing at her and whispering, "This one." Tesh had noticed Bryn when he had lived under the wool with Malcolm and Wraith in Tyre. There had been more girls there, pretty ones too, but Tyre ladies were a different breed, wearing sandals and dresses of dyed linen. Bryn wasn't a Dorean girl, she was softer than that, but she wasn't a Tyre lady either. Long brown hair, face as cute as a morning chipmunk, with high cheeks and smiling eyes. Since the weather had warmed, he'd seen her in the training yard, always with that satchel. Everyone else noticed her, too. Even the old men watched for Bryn, and when she sat out on the grass, the trainees nudged each other and pointed, first at her, and then at him. This warning gesture spread until all the other students moved away, fearful of being paired with Tesh. When Bryn was there, he had a tendency to show off. Tesh wasn't intimidated by many things, but pretending to look for Rome that day had been the most frightening thing he'd done since reaching Alan Rist. It hadn't gone as well as he had hoped. All that talk about row, footprints, and voices in the night didn't set the right tone. At first he thought she might have been messing with him, but when he found the clawed footprint around the corner, he had to take that seriously. Since then, he'd made a habit of going for nightly walks down by her house. He'd circle it, then sit in the shadows by the well, waiting to see if anything was lurking around. Nothing ever was, and when he got too cold, he'd head back to the barracks. Tesh wasn't sure what he was looking for, didn't know what a row looked like. But if anything tried to hurt Bryn, he'd take his training out for a test run. Since their first meeting, he'd spoken to her after every practice. The last four times, she'd allowed him to hold her hand. This time, he hoped to kiss her. The thought had his heart racing. As usual, she was making black marks on incredibly thin sheets of skin with a featherless quill. Usually, she stopped well before he reached her, but this time her brows were furrowed and her tongue stuck partway out of her mouth. According to Moya and some of the others, Tesh did the same thing when aiming a bow. Another connection. This had to be destiny. Didn't it? "Hi again," he said when she failed to look up. None of his training had included classes in eloquence. He had learned how to curse in three languages, but somehow he didn't think calling her a whore in Grenmorian or Frey would impress Bryn. She looked up, and rapidly sucked in her tongue, making a little slurping sound. She opened her mouth after that, but didn't say anything. She just stared. "She's finally fed up, tired of me bothering her, probably wants me to leave. You shouldn't talk to that Duraean boy." Every muscle in his body contracted, and he started to sweat. He needed to say something. For the first time in a half-dozen visits, he asked, "What are you doing?" She continued to stare for a few more seconds, then looked down at her lap as if she'd forgotten.
I was writing.
Writing?
Yeah. I'm the Keeper of Ways for the Rulin clans, and I—
You are? He blurted out,
hating himself.
He was shocked because he thought keepers were old, like that Pedera hag. The one in Dorea had been. He just couldn't imagine a girl as young as Bryn being a keeper. Still, he should have known she wasn't just some girl. She was an orphan, but she was in Alan Rist. All the other women in the Rist were married to, or daughters of, serving soldiers. The rest stayed home in their villages to tend animals and babies. If she was at the Rist, she was special. Bryn nodded.
"I thought you knew."
Tesh shook his head.
"I don't know much, but I guess being keeper, you know everything."
"I think you're confusing keepers with gods. I only know the history of the clans."
"Still, that's not easy, right?"
He was trying to compliment her, sort of like doing a backward parry with his offhand in the first match. He hoped this went better. "I had to memorize the ancient stories word for word from the last keeper, Maeve."
"How long did that take?"
"Years.
I started listening when I was real young. Made my first recital of the Song of Estuary when I was 5. That's when Maeve really started training me. But there were still a few things I never completely learned. That's what this is all about." She laid a hand on the stack of markings. "I'm working at making a permanent account of those stories, so anyone can know them." Tesh knelt down on one knee and leaned in to look at all the wavy marks she'd made.
"Is it magic?"
Tesh knew that the Keenig had magicians working for her. He also knew all of them were women.
"No, These marks just represent sounds, the same ones we speak when talking. If you know which marks make what sounds, you can read them.
Oh,
he said, nodding confidently, but not understanding. He didn't need to. He didn't care. All Tish wanted was for her not to shout at him to go away. Every word he uttered was a gamble and an opportunity.
So, what is it you're writing?
I used to call it the Book Pine Markings of Bryn, but that's too long. Moya shortened it to the Book of Bryn. And I guess that's okay. Makes less sense, but is a lot easier to say. It's going to be the story of the whole world, from how it began to the present.
Since you're from Wren, I suppose you'll say Mara created everything.
Actually, no. Erebus did.
Tesh wasn't an expert on gods. In Dorea, they worshipped the Minagon, the three gods of war, and he knew that Clan the Dak worshipped Bakrakar, the stag god of the hunt, and Wren worshipped Mara. Each of the clans had its own god, but he had never heard of Erebus.
Erebus is the father of all the gods, and he had four children, Therol, Drome, Mara, and Muriel.
I knew Mara would get in there, Tesh said with a smile. He wasn't really interested in the gods, and was ready to move to another topic, like whether she'd consider taking a walk with him.
Talking to her in the open, with everyone watching, was horribly awkward. Humiliation hurt less in private.
The Derg liked to call themselves Belgriklungrians, but they were originally called Dromians. Tesh smiled and nodded. I was wondering if... Do you see it? Do you understand?
Tesh hadn't been paying close attention and felt he'd been caught. He made a guilty grin that he hoped might be seen as charming. Knowing he was asking for too much, he added a shake of his head.
Therol sounds like Frey, and Drome sounds like Dromian, even Derg and Dwarf. They're all variations of the same word. Although Derg comes from the Frey for vile mole, and Dwarf is a runic word to indicate something small, and they shouldn't have anything to do with each other, but I think they might. That somehow all those words come from the same root. That would mean the Frey, Belgriklungrian, and our own language share a common ancestry. I have no idea how that could be possible. And then there's Mara.
She looked at him expectantly,
inviting a response by making a hand-it-over motion with her fingers.
Tesh was at a loss.
I never should have asked what she was doing. Now she thinks I'm...
Bryn smiled at him.
I'm okay. It's like the first part of a joke. She doesn't expect me to know the answer.
The masculine form of the word Mara is Mana. Do you see now?
Thankfully, she didn't even pause to give him time to answer.
Mana sounds a lot like man, doesn't it?
She was excited. Really excited. He could see it in her eyes, bright and wide.
This was important to her, and she wanted him to respond with equal enthusiasm. But all he wanted was a kiss.
Okay, so maybe it isn't so obvious to everyone, she went on when he failed to say anything. Even Rome didn't make the connection. But think about it. Those words aren't similar by accident.
Therol is the god of the Frey, Drome is the god of the Dromians, and Mara is the god of man.
It says so right in the tablets I found in Neath.
Those born of Therol, those born of Drome, and those born of Mara moved out into the world.
You see, we are Mara-born, the children of Mara, daughter of Erebus.
Only...
She looked away, perplexed.
Only what?
None of it makes sense.
I mean, okay, so this Erebus had four kids. But with who?
Ilan?
We call her the grandmother of all, so what does that mean?
For that matter,
who was Mara's husband, or Feral's wife, or Drome's. I don't even know what Drome is. The Belgric Lungrians called the peak above Neath Dome Mountain. Could that be a derivation? And what about Muriel? Did she have children? Maybe she made the plants and animals. I don't know, but someone had to, right? And where did Erebus come from in the first place? Did he have parents? Wouldn't he have to? And where'd they come from? She sighed. I thought I had it all worked out. Most of it written down. Father of the gods, four kids that made humans, Frey and the Durg. But no. That's what you get from talking to Rhone about anything. She keeps asking why until you want to punch her in the face. Tesh just stared. You want to go for a walk? Rin asked.
Huh?
He blinked.
Oh, sure.
Great, she said. Rin wrapped her pages up in the satchel and capped the ink bottle. Where are we going? He asked. For all his desire to go someplace quiet, Tesh hadn't put any thought into where. I'd love to go for a walk in a forest, but there aren't any. Have you been in the Verinthian? Not much. Bryn smiled. I'll give you a tour. Tesh grinned. I'd like that. He took her hand, and they set off. The Verinthian was beautiful, and Bryn hoped he would be impressed. While not forbidden, the rotunda was reserved for official business, which left it empty much of the time. Bryn had been there often, as she attended every meeting conducted beneath the dome. She also found it a good place to write when the weather was bad. Here, I want to show you something. She pulled him up a flight of stairs to the platform where Persephone and Nephron made their speeches. The sunlight shone through the skylights, but it was late in the day, and the dais wasn't illuminated. She led him to its center, and then whispered in his ear, "Say something." Her heart beat quickly with the intimacy of being so close, her lips so near to him. "Something," he said, and his eyes went wide in amazement at the tremendous volume produced. "How did you do that?" he exclaimed. Spoken louder, these words echoed. He turned, searching for the speaker who was mimicking him. Then the truth dawned, and he smiled. Bryn smiled, too. She led him off the stage, and they circled around and went out to the tiered benches. This is where all the important people sit when Nephron and Persephone are addressing them. She took Tesh's hand again and led him across the tile to a door in the back. I discovered a world of hallways and doors beneath this place. I tried nearly every one. Most are open, but some are fastened shut. Behind a few, I've heard noises. Maybe they keep some livestock down here. Goats or pigs. Haven't seen any, but it's kind of interesting. Come on, I'll show you. They dipped their heads under an arch, descended a set of stone steps, and entered a carved-out passageway. The upper portion of the corridor was made of blocked stone, the lower section hewn from natural rock. They were entering the body of the butte, and Tesh had to admit it was a little creepy, like going into a cave. Still, he didn't care. He was alone with her, and that was all he wanted. "Did you get your armor?" Bryn asked, as she grabbed a torch and led him down the steps. "No. You couldn't find Rhone?" "Oh, I found her. It's just they want me to wait. I'm not sure why." He knew exactly why. They said he would grow out of it in just a few months. He was the only one who could go toe-to-toe with Sebek. They'd sparred 12 times. But he was too young for armor. He wasn't going to tell her that. "You came down here by yourself. Isn't this a little scary?" Bryn shrugged.
I've seen worse. I went with Persephone to Neith, and let me tell you, dwarfs know how to dig deep. This is nothing.
Oh, right, Chesh said. You fought a row, didn't you? I suppose this is a walk in a dewy field next to that.
She waved the torch at a clot of cobwebs, burning them away. It's a little scary, but not with you. Not with Teklor, who's fought Sebek 12 times and only received 1 scratch.
She has been watching.
Speaking of scary, he said, have you had any more visits from the Rao?
No, just that one night. She stopped at the bottom of a narrow corridor. Across from them, an open door revealed a small chamber with dry straw on a dirt floor. Bryn stared at it, as if trying to make up her mind about something.
Tesh had an idea what it was. At least, he hoped he did. There were few places in the city where 2 people could be alone.
Tesh moved past her into the room.
It's all right. Nothing to worry about in here, see?
She stood in the hallway, watching him with big eyes, biting her lower lip. Tesh put his hand to the wall.
Stone is dry. He sniffed. No mildew or mould. Not a bad little place. Nicer than my home in Dorea, actually.
Bryn placed the torch in a sconce outside and entered, taking unusually short steps. As she moved toward him, Tesh found he had to take 2 breaths to gain the same amount of air. He placed his hands on her hips, drawing her closer. As he did, he noticed Bryn was having the same issue with the air, her chest rising and falling. Tesh leaned in, pressing against her. She was trembling. He was too. Their lips, less than a finger's width apart, drew in a common breath. His arms slipped around her. She answered by closing her eyes. Then, as his lips touched hers, Bryn arched up, meeting him.
Tesh had never kissed a girl before.
The moment he felt the press of her lips, he stopped thinking.
Nearly every combat instructor had stressed the need to be in the moment, to not be pondering the future or past. Such a thing wasn't as easy as it seemed. So much of everything was held in the vessel of what came before, and the anticipation of what came next. Blocking out those thoughts was as hard as forgetting he existed. Tesh was certain he'd never achieved that singular state of perfection, never even knew what he was aiming for. Until that kiss. In 1 flawless moment, Tesh forgot the rest of the world. He might have stood pressed against Bryn for hours or days, lost in the smell of her skin, the feel of her hair. His only thought, I can't believe I'm really doing this. Legs weak, they slid down the wall to the dirt and straw. Some part of him wondered how he was still getting air, but it was a thought with no more substance than the cobwebs. Then everything changed. Bryn stopped kissing. Her whole body went rigid, and he felt her muscles tighten as she pushed him away.
What's wrong? What did I do? Does she think I was pulling her to the floor? Did she think I was going to...
I didn't...
He started to apologize, but stopped when he saw the terror on her face. It wasn't him she was upset with. She was horrified, but acted as if he wasn't there. She retreated to the door, pulled the torch free of the sconce, and brought it down toward the floor.
Look, she said.
Their movement in the cell had brushed aside a patch of straw. The flickering glow revealed a familiar 3-toed footprint, one with claws.
Chapter 12. The Witness. Alan Rist had been the 4th Thane, the first from the Instaria tribe, and the first male ruler of Erevan. He took power in the midst of the Derg War after Fain Gika of the Ascendoir had been killed in the initial battle. For 5 dark years he had fought a losing war against the Derg. After his death, Rist became the only Fain to be buried west of the Nidwalden River. The fortress that bore his name was also his tombstone. The Book of Brynn. As Suri walked, her feet gave rise to a cloud of dust. It was unlike the sickly yellow soil of Dorea, easily disturbed and slow to settle. There, the pallid grit collected on her assica, muting its colour, dulling everything. Here the dirt was light, but the air was heavy. Spring breezes failed to lift the sense of suffocation. It couldn't. The stifling misery Suri felt wasn't caused by weather. Months of working with Arion had opened countless doors that Suri had previously ignored. Hand in hand, they had explored those new corridors, and with each discovery, Suri's understanding of the art increased. With understanding came awareness. The more she learned, the more she realized how little she knew. In the past, she had overlooked so many things that had screamed for her attention. She hadn't been blind to them, just never noticed. People always did that. So devoured by their own problems, they never noticed the wild flowers in their path. That spring, she saw the world in a new way. She had learned to not merely look, but to see. Not everything she saw was pleasant. Overhead, the dark wings of 7 vultures circled against a grey sky that was too big, too bare, too vacant. "How can there be no trees?" Suri asked, and let her arms clap her sides, issuing a burst of yellow dust. "There's a tree." Wraith pointed at an ancient stump whose long dead roots resembled the skeletal remains of a hand clutching a fistful of rocks. "That's not a tree."
"Used to be a tree."
Suri turned her head side to side, viewing the entire tabletop plain. "Is that what happened? People cut them all down?"
Wraith shook his head.
"Don't think there were many to start with."
The two had left the Rist early that morning. No plans had been made, no rendezvous agreed to. Suri had awakened with itchy feet, the sort of irritation that could only be calmed by a good solid walk over new ground. She found Wraith at the ford, standing on the bridge and looking down into the chasm where the river rushed. She, too, had paused to take a peek. Nothing was said. No greeting. Not even a wave. When Suri moved on, Wraith fell into step alongside her. That's how it usually happened. Wraith likely felt it was coincidence, but armed with her new sight, Suri recognized more was at work. In terms of the art, the language of Elan, she saw it as a golden thread that connected the two of them, just as she felt linked to Arion. This heightened connection indicated a relationship of importance, and the reason they so often found each other at just the right time. Suri imagined that she would have noticed a similar thread between her and Maeve, had she known how to see it back then. What significance that thread indicated, Suri had no idea. But that was how the sight, as Arion sometimes referred to it, worked. In a way, they were puzzles, clues, bits and pieces of half-heard conversations. Suri liked mysteries, but all too often, when put together, these puzzles revealed unhappy pictures.
"How did you live here, without—"
Suri shook her head.
"It's not just the lack of trees. There's so little life. No greenery. All rock."
"Now you know why we crossed the burn. Look."
Wraith pointed back west and slightly south, where the land turned a lush green. The Frey call it Averlin.
Green hills.
Surrey translated.
Yep.
He gestured longingly with his hands at the sight. In my village, I woke up every day, and there it was, right across the river. Look at it. Paradise rising up into the clouds. We weren't allowed there. That was the land of gods. He sighed and frowned as his sight returned to the rocky world around them. This, we were told, was our place, our divinely prescribed lot, what we deserved. Wraith scraped his boot on the face of the stone escarpment he stood on. In a way, they were right. This land suited us. Dry, hard, barren, prone to extremes of hot and cold. But... he looked at her. I wonder how much of that came from living here. If we all lived where you did, would we have been different? Wouldn't matter, Surrey said. Regardless where you're born, the world has a way of finding you and ruining everything. Wraith looked surprised. She shrugged. Okay, not everything, and maybe not utter ruin, but nothing stays the same. She resumed their hike along the edge of the canyon, looking for routes down. During the cold of winter, all they could comfortably handle were short explorations of the city. Sometimes Tesh or Malcolm came along, but mostly it was just her and Wraith. They had tried crossing the ford months before, but the winds and snow of Dorea were brutal. The city, with its twisting narrow streets, was sheltered but complicated. Exploring it provided just enough adventure to keep her sane. After months of darkness trapped in stone, the fortress became an uncomfortable cage. But when she and Wraith teamed up and slipped out, they were, for a short time, free. The advent of spring felt like the end of a prison sentence. They were out, the day was hot, and Surrey was intent on swimming. She just needed to find a way to descend the cliff.
There's no way down, Wraith told her.
She frowned.
Wouldn't have been nice anyway, he continued. Maybe down by the crescent in high summer it's a fine swim. Up here in spring it's ridiculously cold, and I know that from experience.
She hadn't told him what she planned. Until she mentioned the lack of trees, the two hadn't spoken all morning. Still, he knew. Only once before had Surrey experienced that degree of harmony, that sense of comfortable companionship that had no need for questions or answers. She couldn't help feeling a little guilty.
"Rivers age as they go downstream,"
Surrey told Wraith, while they looked at the disagreeable gorge. "That's what Tura once told me. They start out as tiny trickles, then in their youth and adolescence are like this. Boundless energy, throwing themselves heedless against unmovable rocks. Then they usually fall. Sometimes it's a series of tumbles, and sometimes one great plummet. But hitting bottom usually takes the fight out of most rivers. After that, they mellow and learn to meander around the rocks they encounter, taking life slower, easier. They spread out and grow quiet until, at last, they flow into the sea, becoming one with something greater. Wraith's eyes grew glassy. His lips squeezed shut, and a moment later he wiped away tears. For the first time, she was baffled.
"Sorry," he said. It's just that you remind me of my sister. She would have been about your age, and she used to talk like that."
He looked at his feet.
"I don't miss too many people, but I miss her. I remember laughing when she was around. She had a way of doing that, even on the cold nights when there was no food. I can't remember the last time I laughed. And in all honesty, being with you.